Hey everybody, John Shires, alcoholic. It's my great pleasure to introduce our speaker tonight, Sia Ford from Los Angeles, California. I met her on a trip out there. I went to a meeting, and here's this like 6'5" looking supermodel vampire standing at the front of the room, dressed all in black, just bringing the AA message so hard. And I walked right up to her after the meeting, and I think I freaked her out. She'll probably testify to that in a minute. And she said, "I gotta get you to come speak in Georgia." And anyway, and she did come and speak for us a few years back, and I'm just thrilled to have her here tonight. When I called her a few months ago and said, "Hey, would you come out for this Atlanta Roundup event and speak at the Fifth Tradition Group?" She said, "Well, that's a tough day because the day before I'm flying back into LA from out of town, and then I would have to turn around, and is it okay if I arrive at like 7 p.m.? And I said, "Actually, it's not okay for you to arrive at 7 p.m. because we'll never make it to Buford from the airport for you to speak at 8 p.m. She said, "Well, the only other flight arrives at like 3, which means I have to get on the plane at 4 o'clock in the morning. But because I love AA and because I love you, I will do that." So she got to the airport this morning in LA at 4 a.m. to be able to get here to speak tonight. Wow. And I got a text at like 4:15 a.m. She says, "I said I'd do this because I love AA and because I love you. Now I'm only doing it because I love AA." So please welcome Sia Ford.
Sia, alcoholic, too.
Yeah.
I used to love AA. Oh, it's so nice to be here. I'm delighted to have been invited. I want to thank the committee. It's hard work doing. I've never organized a roundup, but I've been part of a committee doing things in AA, and it's like you use every tool in your program to pull it off and negotiate the food and get the stuff set up, all that back-end stuff that, you know, we walk in, it's all set up, and you maybe don't notice. And I just want to notice it myself. I'm not saying you guys don't notice it, but, okay, I got off, and it was early, but you guys have been planning this for a while. And also want to say it's nice to be with alcoholics physically. I have been grateful to Zoom, but it's just there's something about meeting that really cannot be replicated. So I'm so happy to be among you. And forgive me, you know, I've been giving people not the hand of AA, but the elbow of AA, because I live with somebody who's pretty compromised, and I want to be mindful of that. So I appreciate your latitude there. And it's been nice to meet some of you and see new folks again, and the taco was killer. It's just great. It's great. So I hardly remember I woke up at 3 in the morning. I hardly remember anything.
I don't know what I'm going to say, huh?
So if you're new, are there new folks here? Are there people here with like 6 months or anybody?
Yay.
Okay, and AA has been good to me. My sobriety is January 30th, 1983. I am impressed with what Alcoholics Anonymous has done with me. And you know what? I feel like that's on loan to me. I don't know how you parlay your sobriety. I say it's on loan to me because since it's my third time in AA, what I want to keep in mind is it ain't mine. You know, it ain't mine. There's something in the book, maybe you've seen it too. It says that we can't remember with sufficient force the remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the night before. So how am I going to remember it for 38 years? I ain't, you know. And so I come to AA and I do this kind of thing. You give me the opportunity to remember because my rememberer is busted. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous is my rememberer. And I count on that. I count on, as Kathy's doing and John's doing and Damon's doing and all you other folks are doing, the readers are doing, Alex is doing, Justin is doing, you know, the newcomer's doing by being here, you know. You give me a reason, and I get to tell you my story, but I'm the one that really needs to hear it more than anybody else. And so you guys can go to sleep. I'll just talk to myself. I do it anyway all the time. People say, "You're so weird. You're talking to yourself." Yes, I am. I am weird. And if you are newer here, you know, I am a weird person. In fact, the reason that you asked me to share is because I was talking about how Clancy, he was my first sponsor in the sobriety, he said, You'll always be a few streets over from the parade. Which is funny. And then my mind, although I did not say this aloud to him, I was like, it takes one to know one. You know what I mean? I fit in here. And that is not a casual thing for an alcoholic of my type. I don't know about you. I didn't fit in any place. I didn't know that's what was going on. You know, we use this word identification, and it's, to me, unique to AA. But here's the thing. At some point in my sobriety, I realized, you know what? I just wasn't identifying in the place I think normal people do. There's lots of places they don't use that word. And that was my problem right from the gate. I'm a person who doesn't just over-drink. I like over-marry. I over-like people who under-like me. You know what I mean? You know, I oversleep. I overdraft. I cannot get it right. I cannot do it. And I finally thought, you know what? Your mind is just booby-trapped. That is a hard thing. You can't get away from it. I cannot get away from it. And you gave me a way up and out and a way to go. And I'm a person who you can set your watch to the fact I'm going to drink again if I'm not in AA. And you can also set your watch to the fact I'm going to blow my stack at you if I'm not working a program. Anger was, I think, a counterfeit power, I guess. It made me feel big. And I was an angry kid. I was a very angry, angry person. One of the folks I was overmarried to said to me one time, you know what, I actually think you are the angriest person I have ever met. To which I replied, that makes me angry, you know. Because I got nothing, really. I got nothing. And I was trying to hide that all my life. I felt weird that I didn't fit in. And here's the thing. There's certain things about alcoholism that drove me crazy before I drank. And I'm going to talk about that for a minute, but I want to talk about this identification thing, because it was the reason I'm standing here with you, one of the building blocks of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't feel like I identified with my family. I did not feel a part of in my family. My family were real nice-looking people. And I was like this tall, skinny thing with buck teeth and scraggly hair. That is a direct quote from a police report. And it takes like creative writing in the police academy. But yeah, and so I just didn't see, you know, it felt bad. And then I went to kindergarten. I'm going to talk about spiritual malady for a minute because I haven't. I peaked at like 5, you know. I went to kindergarten and it got worse. It did. Because you know what's in kindergarten? These things called people. And what are they for? You know, they're like looking at you like you guys are looking at me. And for some reason, I always felt like dirt about myself. And I thought that they were thinking that about me. Now, it's one thing if I'm thinking it. I don't know if you're like this, but you don't get to think it. And the way I approach problems like this is I sized up the situation, and I realized there was, like, too many of them to kill, you know? it's a ridiculous thing to say, but it is how my mind works. So they're laying on their little mat in kindergarten, and I'm busy thinking how to take them out or something, you know? And it just doesn't make you kind of a social butterfly. And I'm a kid who I joined a gang. Some people do that, you know, you try to find a place. And these folks were, to me, they were militaristic. You know, in the book it talks about defiance as our outstanding characteristic. I still hate somebody telling me what to do. My sponsor will tell me what to do, and there's this small, evil person in the back of me that has something to say about it. And I can usually put my hand over their mouth, you know, but I just don't appreciate it. And so these people were, like, telling me what to do, and there was this uniform thing, and I just started, like, showing them what I thought of their culture. You know, we have traditions. We're not the only organization that has certain things that we codify. And these folks had that. And I just started, you know, doing a little of this, a little of that. And, you know, what I'm talking about, this gang is called Girl Scouts, by the way. Because I'm real bad, you know. I'm a tough. Anyway, they started to pay attention when they realized I was doing something funny with their cookie money. Now, if you know anything about Girl Scouts, you may. You know, this is their brand. This is a big deal. And they did not mess around. They had a little meeting. And the upshot was I no longer got to be a Girl Scout. And did somebody say aw?
Oh. I'm staying.
Yeah, and here's the thing about that. There's something in the book. By the way, if you're newer, I'm a textbook alcoholic, and a textbook alcoholic, I mean the big book. I am in that book. I love that book because it describes my problem, but it also describes my solution. And I, too, work with newer people, and it's kind of fun to say to them, you know, the title of the chapter is There Is a Solution. It does not say, yes, you're right, Sia, you're screwed. You know, because that's how I felt. That's how I felt. And so there is something in the book that says this is the beginning of a fatal progression. It is referring to our drinking. But I'm going to tell you this. It could have referred to the trajectory of my life because we have patterns that we create as we're moving through life. I do, like a steamroller. And then we do these inventories, which are kind of like forensics in a way, you know, like I'm a crime scene. I was a crime scene when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know how you felt about it. And they help identify problems in my life. And I found out that the beginning of the fatal progression was every organization that I became a part of, up to and including my own family, would uninvite me to be in that organization. And you know, that's a weird thing to try to come back from. I didn't know how to do it, but you did. And if you're newer, I want to give you a little hope. You know, I lost my family because of my drinking, but I got my family back. I didn't even want my family back, you know. I don't want. But I don't know a whole lot, and that's what I've learned in AA. I'm a big know-it-all. And don't you hate know-it-alls who don't? You know, and I was one of those. I tried to blow some of this stuff off. I don't know if you did it. You know, it talks about we have an allergy to the body and an obsession of mind. And I knew when I drank, I developed an allergy, like, to the boyfriend I was with and an obsession for yours, you know. And I'm not that kind of person. So I'm like, you know, give the book to somebody who needs it. I got this covered. And I did not have it covered. But I'm, like, the last to know. So anyway, kindergarten did not work out. Girl Scouts did not work out. I also, I don't think you identify in the church in which I was raised if you pull the fire alarm during communion. I just think something is not clicking there, you know? And I didn't act alone, you know? My brother and I did that. But people just don't appreciate it. And my mom kind of got between me and the Monsignor. You know, or you would have had another speaker, maybe. I don't know. People were not glad to see me. I'll tell you something I don't take for granted, and I'm grateful for this. I don't take for granted being invited back. I don't. I hope I never do. Because there was a time, and I guess that happened for you, because I don't know what you're doing here otherwise, when I was not welcome. And I knew I was not welcome. There were times I was not welcome, and I didn't know it, and I would show up, you know, and I was not welcome. And I didn't know what to do. I had no tools. No tools. As far as I know, no tools. Rage and the bottle. So I grew up in an alcoholic home. Some of you may have. It ain't why I'm an alcoholic, but I saw it, and it made an impression on me. The alcoholic, the self-professed alcoholic, was my dad. My dad was this great big guy. My dad was 6'7". My dad played All-American basketball in Madison Square Garden. He was a gifted athlete. He got some attention in the newspapers. He went on to become a successful businessman for a brief period of time. And then, like the book says, his alcoholism caught up with him. And here's what I saw. I saw powerlessness. I couldn't have said the word. I wouldn't have understood the word. But I saw it, you know. And what I saw was this. Alcoholism doesn't care how big you are. And it doesn't care if you're good at something. And it doesn't care if you're getting attention in the newspapers, or you're successful at something, or your ethnicity, or your religion, or who you know, or how much money you got in the bank. It doesn't care. It just, from what I saw, it bores its way through your life and dumps it out on the other end, along with your guts, you know. And that's what happened to my father. And, you know, alcoholism is not contagious, like this thing that has kept us inside. But you know what I think? This is just me. It's spiritually contagious. Otherwise, how come we have this sister program, Al-Anon? People are profoundly affected being around alcoholism. And it drove me insane. You know, I'm a loner. And the reason I was a loner is because when I'm alone, it makes sense to be lonely. But I was lonely in my family. And that was so weird to me. And I didn't have the words for it, maybe, or didn't want to talk about it. I kind of went underground. This is not the way you should feel. That's how I felt about it. And you know what else? I didn't believe in powerlessness for a long time. And this weird thing happened. I became powerless. You don't have to explain it to somebody when it happens to you. You can't, I think, explain it to somebody it has not happened to. And when it happened to me, I got it. I didn't know what to do about it, but I got it. It ain't the word I maybe used, but it's where you're sliding off the roof, and there's nothing to grab, you know, and that's how it got for me. So my dad, you know, alcoholism is an illness. It has its way. And my dad lost most of his material possessions, and the family goes down with the alcoholic. And then the other thing my father lost, which made a really lasting impression on me, is he lost his place in our community. And this is what happens with alcoholics. You know, we have to be removed. You know, we drive drunk, you gotta be removed from the car. You're violent with your family, you gotta be removed from the kids. You're not a responsible employee, they gotta can you. You know, and that's how it goes. And that's how it went with my father. And, when I was 17 or 18, I had my first official drink. And, it was no big deal. It was in a local college watering hole. And so here's what was going on there, for me. There's these things called people there. You know, I don't like people. I have a fear of people without a program. I can't explain it to you, but I do. They're gonna oppose me. That is my spiritual position without a program. It just is. And, you are so crazy. Nobody's laughing but him. You are so weird.
Takes one to know one.
Defiant. You're defiant. And, so I was afraid of the people, but then I was afraid of the drink. Because I'd seen what drinking did to my dad, and I wondered if something bad would happen to me. And fear of the people went out, and I took the drink. And it was a beer. It was no big deal. And what I'm going to say to you is I really can't say if it was the first sip of this beer, or the middle of the glass, or the bottom of the glass, or the bottom of the pitcher, or the bottom of the evening. I don't know. But somewhere along this line, this problem I had all my life. And you know, we have obsession. We talk about obsession. And that was probably my first obsession. And what it was is this. I'd look at you in your family. Because I was looking. You know, I sizing things up. I'd compare myself to people. We talk about that in AA. Compare and despair. I was despairing. I looked at you in your family. I looked at you in kindergarten. I looked at you in church and Girl Scouts and all the places that didn't work for me, where I felt terrible and where I couldn't figure out even what to say about it to anybody. You looked cool. I felt terrible. And that was my problem. And for some reason, that night, that problem I had all my life that I thought about plenty of times, like kind of put its hat on and packed its bag or something and walked out the back door of my life. And I noticed it. And I made the connection. And so what I'm going to say to you, I don't know about you, but when something fixes a problem, as tantamount as that problem was to me, I'm going to seek it out. I'm going to get my hands on it as often as I can. And so I began to drink as often as I could. And I began to do this thing we call taking geographics. I'm a geographic taker. And if you're newer and you don't know the term, you know, things heat up, you move on. And that's what I do. And, you know, suicide's a geographic. It's a geographic I've taken. It's the quickest way out of town for a lot of us. What worked in my favor is I ain't any better at dying than I am at living, you know. And I've done dumb stuff. I'm a dumb person. It just shows you can get sober if you're dumb. I'm not kidding. Because I've done such dumb stuff. Like, when I would have a bad day, I'd like get a bottle. I'm from California. We have earthquakes. I'd like park under a bridge and, you know, just wait.
Sounds cutting out.
Sorry. Sorry, I don't know what's going on.
One time I had a bad day and I overdosed, but it was like no dose. Ridiculous. I was ridiculous. And I felt ridiculous. And it's why I hated people, because they'd point this out to you. They'd point out to you how you behave when you're drinking. And you do something stupid like live. And they'd point that out to you. And so it just felt like that. You know, the difference between today for me, one big difference, and what it used to be like is this. We got this COVID thing. I'm not bringing in outside issues, but I want to say something that occurred to me actually pretty recently. We got this thing, COVID. That's a big problem. We got some social dissension in the country. Here's the difference between those problems and the problems I brought into Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't cause those problems. Now, I have a chance to be part of the solution with those problems. I didn't cause those problems. But every problem I brought into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was at the bottom of. Every single one. And I felt terrible about those problems. And there's this old saw in AA, I don't know if you heard it, where this guy comes to after the San Francisco earthquake, and he looks around and he says to himself, how am I ever going to pay for all this? That's ridiculous. I know, it's funny, but didn't you feel like that? I felt like that. By the time I came to AA, well, I was killing myself, you know. I just felt irredeemable. I didn't know a way out. I knew no way. And we have a way up and out. And so that's how it was going for me. So I started drinking as often as I could. And the effect produced for me in alcohol, you know, we like to talk about that a little bit. I would say, basically, I think drinking gives me superpowers. That's what I would say to you. Now, I can't tell you what superpowers. I think that's called a black one. But something happened. It happened for me. And it wasn't going good for you sometimes, but it was going great for me. And so I started drinking on the reservations. I grew up in Montana. We have reservations there. And that was another thing that helped me out with how alcoholism drove me crazy, because I felt so different from my family, and that was weird. But I had a reason to feel different on the reservation. They were different from me. It made me comfortable, you know what I mean? And the other reason that I drank on reservations was, I don't know what you're like when you drink, but I'm kind of, you can't be sure where I'm going to come from. I can be very friendly. I have been, this is the extreme of my friendliness. It's the extreme I've been made aware of. I see somebody, I don't know your name, but you look great. And I just take my clothes off. Which could work if it wasn't at a wedding reception. I just can't pick the right place, you know, to express myself, I guess. And so that's bad. That's the word gets around, you know. And and the other reason that I drank that's not the other reason I drank on the reservation. Oh, yes, it is. I almost forgot the reason. The other way that I act when I drink, the other extreme, is I can come at you with a knife. I've done that. Men, mostly. And, you know, it never occurred to me until about 10 years ago that, how interesting, nobody turned around and said, oh, yeah? Because, you know, I don't know how to handle a knife. I don't know what to do with a knife but pick it up. And if somebody called me out about it, I don't know what I'd have done. Nobody did that. Sometimes things, you know, you get the, I've lived to the other side of myself. I've been given the privilege of that thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've had occasion to notice that there were things that worked in my favor that I would never have noticed. And that was one. Nobody challenged me there. So the reason it was great to drink on the reservation is they didn't have my family's phone number. They couldn't call and complain about my behavior. That was a new freedom and a new happiness for me, you know. It was great. And I think basically when I drink, I get hope. I don't know how you'd articulate it, but that's what it is. And I didn't feel hopeful, so I'm going to chase that feeling like to the end of the line, you know. I stay out all night when I drink. And that's what I was doing. And at this time in our family life, my parents had separated. And now my mom is a single parent. I'm living with my mom. And my mom has kids younger than me in the house. She's got financial problems. You know, my mom might have felt like her life was over. Look, I've lived a long time now, and I've had problems. And sometimes they've overwhelmed me, you know. But it never occurred to me. John and I were talking about understanding being self-centered. And I remember when you presented me with that hypothesis, if you will. I just bristled at that. I was like, of course I was self-centered. I was terrified. You know, I was like trying to help myself. But it never occurred to me to ask my mom how she was doing. It never occurred to me. Never. Not one time. And when I realized that was so, I got it. I got it. That I could completely miss you because all I'm thinking about is me. And so I was coming home in the morning, and one of my brothers took me to task for acting like that. And, you know, I got this little attitude in me. And you ain't talking to me like that. I'll kill you. I'll kill your whole family, even if you are my family, you know. And I'll kill myself while I'm at it, too, you know, just to have a... So we got in a fist fight, my brother and I, and my mom got caught between us trying to break it up. And it's that thing in the book. It talks about we're problem people. We're the unwelcome hanger-on. We're the X Factor, and that was me. And this is when my mom had to ask me to leave. And just to cut to the chase there, I ended up drinking in Beverly Hills. Now, this is another part in the book for me. It's this part in the book, there's a line called whistling in the dark. And I don't know how you relate to that. But the way that I relate to that is that things were starting not to work out so great when I drank. Not every time. It's this little slide. Some people go down real fast. Maybe I did, but I started to end up in situations where I had to compromise myself. I started to end up in places where I had no reverse. I couldn't vet people properly. I wasn't paying attention to things. And so the evenings didn't always end up so great. And, this is when I started dressing things up. This is when, look, I'm a big fat liar, pants on fire, you know, without a program. This is when I started telling myself things were looking better than they were, because what I could not look at or would not look at is my drinking. My drinking was the common denominator. I ain't doing it. No, it was still doing something for me. And so I said I was drinking in Beverly Hills. The truth of the matter, if you lay it all out, is I was drinking at the bus stop in Beverly Hills. That's a little different story. And I was drinking at the bus stop in Beverly Hills, and I ended up downtown, way downtown in Los Angeles, at this place called The Good Night, which it wasn't, so I wouldn't look it up if you visit. It was a rough bar, actually. And truth in advertising, it should have just been called Rough Bar. That would have been right. And, you know, sometimes when young women drink in rough bars, stuff happens. There was another young woman who drank in that bar. Her name was Debbie. I wasn't friends with her. I don't make friends real well without a program. But here's what happened. One night, Debbie ended up with her head blown off in the vacant lot behind the building this bar was located in. And here's the thing that got me about that. I don't know what kind of violence was in your drinking. That wasn't typical of mine. And here's the thing also. I was a lot like Debbie. And it got close enough to me, I thought, this could have been you, Sia. And so this is when I started talking to myself about my drinking. This is like when I first think I started doing that. I said, you know, why don't you wise up? Maybe you have had more than your fair shares. Why don't you chill? And this is when I found out I could not stop drinking. Because what happened is the same thing that happened with anybody who started questioning my drinking. Now I just start drinking behind my own back now instead of yours, you know. And it's kind of a weird thing. Here's the deal for me. I'm an alcoholic woman. I've been places I shouldn't have been. Stuff's happened to me that shouldn't happen. I've not been in control of my own body. I've not been paying attention to the people that I ended up with. I have used abortion for birth control. I do not say that to be distasteful. What I'm trying to convey to you is there were things I believed in, and I didn't really have anything intact in that department when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I could not summon a reason, really, to continue sometimes. I felt irredeemable, not worth the paper I was printed on. In AA, we say bondage of self. I was in the bondage of self. And a couple things happened that propelled me into Alcoholics Anonymous. I was burglarized around this time. Like, I didn't notice for a couple weeks. Can you picture that? I just caught myself. You know, like you catch yourself in the mirror. I have a friend who talks about it. It's so funny to me how she got way down there and she passed the mirror one time and she said, she used a bad word. So I'll just use, she said, who in the F is that? You know, that's how it was. I hardly could recognize myself, more spiritually maybe than physically. I just didn't know who I was. And I couldn't stand myself. And the other thing that happened is I was looking out of the window one day at the place where I was living at the time. It was day. And I saw this guy walking down the street with a shotgun. Now, I'm from Montana. I know a shotgun when I see one. But this was Los Angeles, and that was, to me, pretty out there. It ain't the Wild West there yet. And the way it worked out, I said to myself it was lucky. But the way that I see it now, I see a lot of things different now. And John and I were talking when we were driving from the airport. There are things I recognize, the way they played out, I didn't have anything to do with it. It was something kind of helped me out. That's how I see it. You don't have to see it that way. And this was a circumstance like that, because when I saw the guy cross the street, come in the courtyard, and heard him coming up the stairs to my door, I knew he had a shotgun. So I did not open the door. I didn't know what to do, but be real quiet. And you know, there's a part in Bill's story where he talks about his mind is racing. And my mind was racing. I was thinking, I don't recognize this guy. What's he doing here? Did I do something to him in a blackout? You know, we can be like that. Is it the people I live with? Is that what he's doing here? Because I lived with those kind of people. And they would have been fair to say I was those kind of people, because I was those kind of people. I don't know. All I knew was to be real, real quiet and just wait and see what was going to happen. It reminds me of something else. It was like this minute or however long it was that felt like 1,000 years. You know what I mean? When you're in a bad place and you don't know how it's going to go. And it reminds me of this time that started to happen with my drinking. I'm a little tired, so I'm kind of emotional. You know, where you come to and you say to yourself, I ain't doing this again. I'm not going there. I'm not getting involved like that. It's going to be different. That's what's going to happen. And you say that to yourself, or I did, you know, day after day after day, and it never changes. And so you hear the lie. You know the lie. You can't stand the lie. You just drown it out with a drink. You just drown it out. And that's where my life was. It was like that second that could never turn. And it just wasn't my time. Because I don't know why. I heard footsteps going back down the stairs. He walked out of my life. Maybe there was too much commotion in the courtyard. Maybe he didn't want to kick the door in. I don't know. So this is when I would say to you, I really was ready for some help. I really, really wanted some help. I don't know when that happened in your case, but it was a memorable moment. And here's the problem with me. I'm not a helpable person. I'm not. And a lot of us aren't. AA works. A lot of people have come here. I've tried to help a lot of people. I ain't saying I'm great. I'm just telling you, I've been there. So this works, and I try to. Some people cannot get it, and I can't really tell you how come I did. I'd love to, the big old know-it-all in me, but there's some unknown something for me. And so here's the thing. There were people who tried to help me. And the thing that caught my attention about this in the big book is in the family afterward. Bill Wilson talks about children from alcoholic homes are pathetically cynical. And I thought, maybe that's me, man. Because I don't believe you. Like, I don't know if people helped you, but people could see I was troubled, and some folks tried to help me. A couple of people with those little clerical collars, they tried to sit down with me and talk me through seeing the world a little different. You know, see it through some spiritual points of view. And then there's the people who have a diploma on the wall, and they're going to tell you how to think you know, about your emotions and manage them and cognitive therapy and all that jazz, and that's great. And then there's the ones straight up, they got the gun and the badge and they're going to arrest you, and okay, let's go. But you know what I know about every single one of those folks? You're just another lousy human being underneath all that jazz, just like me, you know. You really can't get to first base there. Here's the thing for me with Alcoholics Anonymous. I have no defense against the first drink. The book proposes that to us. I would say that's true in my case. And I also, interestingly enough, have no defense against Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason for that is simply this. This thing that I mentioned to you, that this is a privilege to talk to you about my story, because this keeps me sober. This helps me. And I appreciate it. This is what people said to me. This is what people say in the book, you know, the foundation of our program in so many ways. And they said stuff to me like, you know, Sia, you ain't a charity case. This is an even playing field here. We're all in this deal. Like Bill talks about the Titanic, you know, where we've been rescued and we share this thing. And that is true in my case also. And it's because you said that to me. You said to me, you know, some of us got more time. We've been through things. There's not a thing I have not experienced that someone in Alcoholics Anonymous has not made it through sober and has helped me by that example. A family member of ours died this last year, a young member of our family, of an overdose, and was my sister's only child, and it just put a crater in our family. The future felt like it walked out the door there. And I know I'm not the only person in this room that has experienced that. And there are people in my group who have lost their own children. This is my niece. And I loved that little bastard. You know what I mean? Loved her to death. And I couldn't handle it. I can't handle it. That's step one in AA if you're new. It applies to many things. John and I were talking about that too. I wake up in step one. I wake up and, no, not again. It's the first thing. First thing. Because you know what? My ego wakes up before I do. And it's all ready and primed. Give me the dire tidings of the day. I don't know about you, but my ego is macho. It is ferocious. It has a mustache, I've decided. And it gets me. And it stampedes me into the living room to do my 10th step. I need help. And I couldn't handle it with my niece. I couldn't handle seeing my sister and her husband cave in. Here's the deal, though. I come to AA where I go, and there's people, they lost their kid. And they show me how to do it. They don't tell me how to do it. And that was your 12-step call to me. You didn't tell me what to do. You tell me what you did. And that got underneath my defenses. I had no defense against that. It saved my life. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the gold standard here, you know. And I have tried to honor that. Because know-it-alls like me start trying to know. You know, and it's like, hold on a minute. Are you talking from experience, Sia? Or is it like you like the sound of your own voice or something? And so that's what you did for me. And that day, I hadn't talked to you yet. I went someplace in the next few days. I was sitting there. I remember some place to eat or have a coffee or whatever. And I was waiting, basically, for the obsession of the mind to hit. Because that's what ran my day. I don't know what set your agenda. That's what ran my day. You know, the book talks about allergy of the body and obsession of the mind. And this time coming into AA, this third time, this too late time, I wanted to get some of this stuff. Now, I'm a spiritually bankrupt person coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. And so now I'm trying to get my hands on some of these terms, you know, get a hold of this thing. And I thought, okay, I got an allergy. I got a different allergy. I got an allergy to penicillin. And I thought, here's what I know about that allergy. I can stake my life on this with you all. I ain't scoring a shot of penicillin again in this lifetime. This will never happen. And I also will stake my life on the fact of something else. I will absolutely drink again if I'm not in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's because of the second feature of alcoholism, this thing I so underrated, obsession of the mind. there's a little line in the book. I don't know if it struck you yet or if it will, but it says the problem centers in the mind. One day I thought, that ain't located in a bottle. That ain't in the past. You know, that's here. That's with me. Right up here. It's here. I got alcoholism. It just ain't drunk. And that is why I need this program, this spiritual program. I do not have a drinking problem. If you have a drinking problem, AA will work great for you, and you're welcome here. But I do not have that. I have this other thing. It's called alcoholism. It ain't a euphemism, it turns out. It ain't a synonym. It is a thing. And it's this iceberg, and on the top is the drinking. And this huge undertow of spiritual malady. That is my problem. I am a resentment machine. I am a problem factory. And I need a program. And that program is managed by a power I do not understand. I'm sitting there and waiting for the obsession of the mind to hit. And I read about Alcoholics Anonymous in the community service section of this newspaper. And as I recall, it says something to me like, Alcoholics Anonymous, where we hold hands, which we normally do, and we pray, and then we don't drink anymore. I remember it saying something like that, and this immediate thought came to me that that was as corny as hell, you know, to just bat it away. But then this other thought came along, like somebody else was sitting there with me, and it said, I want to go, just quietly, I want to go. And that was something in me for my money that wants to live. It wanted to live, and it got the swing vote that day. And so I went to this meeting, and it was a nice meeting. It was a smaller meeting. There was a woman at the door. She gave me her phone number. She said she'd sponsor me. She directed me to the front of the meeting. I went in the meeting. Now, I had come to that meeting for help. I told you I'm not really a helpable person. The book says we have to become teachable. I guess I wasn't yet. So I go to the front of the room. I sit down. The meeting starts. And then the same thing happened to me there that had happened in kindergarten. I got an attack of self-centered fear. And then I wanted to get out of there, you know, to get up and leave. But I was in the front, and I was too embarrassed to do it. And for me, embarrassment is like, you are so weird. It is like, it's one of my 100 forms of fear. Or in my case, I got 102 or something. I don't know if you ever counted them, you know. But anyway, so one of my four, and I... So I just shut down. That's what I do when I'm afraid and there's no way out and I feel, I just shut down. And I didn't hear a thing you said to me in that meeting, not one thing. And I didn't take your damn book. I didn't know your steps, I didn't know your traditions. And I ain't calling that lady. That's how I get help. And I left that meeting and I can't tell you, I'm just going to tell you what happened and here's my interpretation of it. I don't know if God got impatient with me. That sounds so arrogant. I don't know what happened. All I'm going to tell you is it felt to me like God, or whatever this thing is in AA, landed like a comet in my living room a couple hours later. And I say that to you because I went home defenseless, pretty much. I had this lady's phone number. Maybe I threw it away by then. And had taken nothing out of that meeting. And this weird thing came to my attention. This thing that you cannot pay away, pray away, talk your way out of, I can't anyway, hide from, negotiate with. This problem called obsession of the mind, that thing was gone. And the only way that thing went anyplace at that point is if I drank. And I had to ask myself, because I had not had a drink. I had to just ask myself, did you have? No. And so I think I was given a moment of grace there, not to take credit for it, not to say I had enough, not to say I wised up. I felt like I'd gone to this place, you guys, for help. And something helped me. I did not understand it. And I have not come to understand it. I have come to understand something. And what I will tell you is I've been looking over my shoulder ever since. Something in Alcoholics Anonymous seemed to help me that day. And I will tell you I drank again. But that moment has remained the dividing line of my life before and after. I could not forget you. I could not forget you. I tried to drink you away after I couldn't stop drinking again because that's what happened to me. And I couldn't blot it out. You know, we blot out the consciousness of our existence. Yeah, I went there, but I couldn't blot out this thing that happened to me. And I felt great. I mean, you do, right? When the obsession is lifted. And as I told you, I thought I had a drinking problem. And I thought you fixed my problem. You know, done, great, you know, one and done. And if something comes up, I know where you are. I'll be right back. And I was full of self-reliance. And the book talks about self-reliance fails us. That is something that is a continuing surrender on my part. I will still feel self-reliant. But I got AA between me and that. That is crazy thinking. Because alcoholism is incurable and it is progressive. And it isn't like drink. It comes in far more cunning, baffling, and powerful ways. And so I'm full of self-reliance. Things just happened for me. I was ecstatic. We talk about a pink cloud experience where I got sober, and I guess I had one, you know. I was leaping out of bed in the morning, and I was full of ideas and full of energy because I had this monkey off my back. And being full of self-reliance like that, thinking I was in charge of this thing, like a credit card with no limit or something, you know, you go crazy. And so I went to what we also call, where I got sober, a slippery place. And met with this person I had a bad history with. And, you know, we also say in AA, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results is crazy. Well, I expected different results because I'm Supergirl now or something, sober Supergirl. And I show up there, and I got mad at them like I always did. And then I blew my sobriety. You know, they were fine. I blew my sobriety. I drank over it. And then I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous looking for that thing that happened in the first meeting. And you know, where do you get that thing? Where do you get the surcease of the obsession? What cup of coffee do you have for that, you know? I had no idea how to get it, and I wasn't asking you for help. I was completely isolated with my alcoholism again. And my program was no match for my alcoholism. I had a little self-knowledge, and that was it. And I swept out the door along with my alcoholism, and I was out there for 7 years. And it got a lot worse. And to tell you the truth, I've never talked to anyone who went out there and it got better for them. Never told me that. It got worse for me. And I ended up in England on a geographic, and I ended up modeling, is what I called it. Got to have an answer when they say, what do you do?
Yeah.
What do you do? Tell you. Come on over here. And I don't know about you, but I'm in the I can't club. You know, in AA we have, if you're new, shorthand of the first three steps, I can't, God can, whatever that is to any of us, let God. And I've always been in the I can't club. It doesn't work that great out there for me. I don't know if it did for you. I can't show up for work, they can me. I don't know if they kept your job for you. I can't make the car payment. They want that car. They take that car. I can't pay the rent. You don't live here anymore, you know. And I can't show up for the relationship. They file, in my case. Terrible, you know. And so that's how it goes. And I'm no different coming in AA, if you're newer. I come in AA, and I turn to somebody, and I said, I can't stop drinking. And somebody turns back to me and says, I can't either. This is the life-saving difference. It's this place that's the difference. One alcoholic talking to another. And the difference is this. You tell me you can't. You qualify what that is. You talk about your drink and how you felt. You're not drinking. How do you do it? I'm mad right away. I want to know. But it's a good mad. It's, you know, and I want to live mad. How? I'm going to steal it. I don't know, you know. So I'm lurking around. And a couple of things happened that had me lurking around here again. I stayed out all night, like I told you I like to do. And I showed up. I actually had a modeling job. I showed up in the morning, and I looked terrible. I know I did. And maybe those people forgot their glasses. I have no idea. They went ahead with this job, and we got the pictures back. And you know what? I look like an alcoholic. I sure did. I don't care how much makeup you put on that. My face was bloated. My eyes were bloodshot. You know, not a vision for you. Ha ha. The client was not amused. They were furious. And they called my agency. And you know, again, it wasn't the first bad day I had at work in that business at that agency. I walked down runways with dresses on backwards. I walked out of my shoes, you know, and it was like, they're just like, get out, just get out. And I did not get a retirement party or a pen, you know. And I just didn't know what to do. There's a thing in the book. It talks about God's everything or God's nothing. And the scales tipped a little bit when the Bank of England then called me. It felt like a nanosecond after I lost my job. You ever have that? Like things just pile up suddenly. And I was overdrawn. I owed them money. I thought I had a fair amount of money. It's that part in the book, you know, where you can't separate the true from the false. It's a crazy feeling, and it should be, because I was. And so, you know, when God's everything for somebody like me, when there's nobody else to call. And there was a woman in that business who had seen me in action, and she'd given me her phone number. She was a sober member. God bless those of us who are comfortable breaking our anonymity in a work situation. And so I called her, and she took me back to AA. She took me to AA in London. And it just wasn't my time. And if you're newer here, I hope it's your time. Ah, damn it. I wanted it to be my time. This time, I wanted it to be my time. You know, the specter of drinking again. You don't want it, but you can't stop. And so you don't know. And that's actually a humbling thing, and I think I needed that. I'm not wishing that for you, but the reason it wasn't my time, and I can tell you this in retrospect because I couldn't tell then, is because I had an attitude. You know, there's a thing in the book that talks about a request is different than a demand. And I had a list of demands. I wasn't announcing it from a podium, but you know, I had it. Like, I was doing you a favor, I guess, being sober. Yeah. You should be, look what you did. Ta-da. And there was a deadline attached to that, apparently, and the time came and went, and you didn't deliver. And I can't remember what particular thing it was, but there's another thing the book says. There's one who has all power. May you find him now. And that day, his name was Gerald. And the reason his name was Gerald is because this guy Gerald was offering to take me on a Geographic. And that was a great idea. I'd take Geographics, you know. Actually, this sobriety was a Geographic. It just worked out good. It was something like that shotgun thing, where there were forces at work that helped me in a way I couldn't help myself. You don't have to believe it, but I do. And so I'm waiting for old Gerald. We're at Gatwick Airport there, and he's buying the tickets. And I feel like God interrupted me, and it was not nearly as convenient as that first time with the shotgun thing, where it seemed like God showed up. This time what happened is Gerald's buying the tickets, and the Federales come swooping down, and they arrest Gerald. And what was more upsetting to me is they arrested the tickets also. You know, it's that thing in the book, take a trip, not take a trip. And I didn't have enough program for not take a trip, apparently. This was not funny to me, and I went home, and you can set your watch to the fact, as I said, I'll drink again if I'm not in AA. I wasn't in AA. I was around AA. There are distinct differences. You know how come I say I'm in AA? It's not because I'm standing here. It's because of the things that are part of my daily life. I have a sponsor. And if you're newer here and you're like me and you don't have a sponsor, oh yes you do, and they're an idiot, it is you. I beg your pardon, because I will make that leap of faith here, because that's exactly what happened to me, you know. If the problem centers in the mind, why are we using your mind to solve your problems here? You're emotionally involved in your problem, and you come up empty every time. Ask the modeling agency. Ask the Bank of England.
Sorry.
He just wanted to come up here. That's all it is. Yeah. Yeah, I know. So, yeah. So I went home and I did what I always do. I didn't have enough program for it, so I went back to my old program. I drank, you know. And I don't even know if I resisted it or if I just... Because I was mad at you. And then I did something I did not understand. I totally got that. The thing I did that I didn't understand is I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to a meeting, and I asked myself, what am I doing here with you losers? You know, is how I was trying to position it. What am I doing here with you? And I didn't want you telling me, because people were always telling me stuff in AA. It was getting on my wick, you know, when you're just like, leave me alone. They obviously thought I needed help. It was so insulting. You know, that's how I was. Like, buzz off. Go make coffee for somebody or something. And so I wanted to figure this out myself. And I thought about it, and I thought about it, and I thought about it in that meeting while I was steaming. And then here's where I got to. It's the thing I said to you that I didn't have my whole life, from my opinion and point of view. Somewhere along the line, I don't know what meeting, I don't know what person was talking, I don't know what they said. Somewhere along the line, I crossed that other invisible line that separates me from you. Identification. I identified with you. And that feeling was something I would say to you I don't think I ever had. It's where Alcoholics Anonymous had become my home. And I was in trouble, and I went home. That's what it was. I needed help. And in spite of myself, I knew you had the help. The cops didn't have the help. My family had asked me not to call again, you know. The agency wasn't going to help me. The Bank of England was looking for me. You know, it wasn't good. And so I came to AA out of fear and a sense that help was here. And if you're new, you know, I hope that happens for you. I ain't here to promote Alcoholics Anonymous. I, in fact, am taught in Alcoholics Anonymous not to promote Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous says not to do that. But I am going to tell you what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. That's what I'm doing here. And I am going to tell you that nothing worked for me but Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am incredibly grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. I am a person who lives in thankful contemplation of whatever it is that presides over us all. And if you struggle with the God word, I did too. If you're newer, I'm going to tell you it is open. It is a different use of the word in Alcoholics Anonymous. It is a placeholder word in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thanks to Jimmy Burwell. You know, it is God as we understand God. It is a higher power. God is anonymous in Alcoholics Anonymous, just like we are. It can be he or she or it. It is tailor-made for a lunatic like me to find some help here, you know. And so I don't know. I was there in that meeting, and there was a stranger in that meeting, and I was in trouble, and I went up to talk to them. Because old-timers, you know, they do that. They let you talk to them if you're going to do it, you know. And this guy was polite and listened to me for a little bit. And then at some point he wrote a phone number down. This guy was a lot more polite than another person I met in AA who made a lasting impression on me. And I'm a person sometimes you need to make a lasting impression. I was going on and on about myself in my second sobriety. And this woman said to me, you know, shut up. She said, if you're an alcoholic, I already know all about you anyway. You're a liar, a cheat, a thief, and a whore, okay? She said, but go in the meeting because you'll be sitting between a liar and a cheat, behind a thief, and in front of another whore. And you never have to be alone again. Yeah, that was good, right? But this person was more polite. He listened for a while, then he wrote a phone number down, and here's what he said to me. He said, you know, Sia, if you got 6 months of your life to give, why don't you work this program as Bill sees it, not as Sia sees it. And he wasn't sarcastic. You know, he just said it straight up, and then he walked away. And so now I'm standing at that turning point, you know, that thing we read in a lot of meetings we do in Southern California, how it works. And it says, we're going to ask God's protection and care with complete abandon. The unsaid thing is, or we ain't. And, you know, I have stood in that moment with a lot of new people. And I've given them my phone number because you gave me yours. And I said to them, you know, give me a call. If I can help you out, I'd be glad to help you out. And sometimes what they say to me is they can't. They can't dial the phone. And you know what I know, because I've been in AA, and I have, it's been hard one thing to learn honesty. That ain't honest. You know how I know that? I can dial a phone. You know what I mean? I can dial a phone. And I can get in a car in normal times or get in a plane like I did today and come on over here. And that is something you cannot do for me. There are certain things. There's a division of labor in Alcoholics Anonymous. We call it footwork. And there is certain footwork only I can do to participate in saving my life. And it doesn't matter how much you're doing if I ain't doing it. And there's 12 steps. There's a million little steps between those 12 steps where I can row for shore, you know, instead of further out into the lake of alcoholism. And so I had a choice that day to dial the phone. You know where I got sober? I just love this, because where I got sober, they're killers. They're exactly what I needed. They say stuff to you like, when I was new, I felt terrible. And they said, you need to get a job. I said, I feel terrible. They said, well, get a terrible job. It is. It's funny. It's, unless it's you making the call and looking for a break. And I would call them because I'd be so depressed when I was new. And I'd call them and I'd say, I can't even get up. I'm so depressed. And they were so kind to me. I remember one guy said, okay, Sia, I'm trying to remember. Are you like a quadriplegic? And then he just hung up the phone. It is funny. You know, it is funny. It's like the point was made. And so there was no other offer on the table this day. If there's somebody here that feels desperate, look, I feel for you. I felt so desperate that day. And you know what? That was the missing link in my runs at AA before. I thought I was desperate, but that day I was desperate. And so it's part of the brick and mortar of my sobriety, desperation. It still is. I get real uncomfortable. That's when I grow. I don't grow when I'm complacent. You know, I start sitting down, maybe not saying hi to the new person because I'm talking to my friends. I start getting uncomfortable and I'm like, wait a minute. You know, alcoholism is gaining on me. Look, I don't live in fear of alcoholism, but I respect it. I respect it as much as I respect Alcoholics Anonymous. It takes us out. And there's no way I should be standing here talking to you guys. You should be walking me to the door, like my family, you know. And something has happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. It has happened to me. And it ain't something that happened in January 30th, 1983, and that's it. You know, like something marvelous that happened in Bethlehem. You know, and no disrespect. Alcoholics Anonymous is a recovery. It's a living program. It continues to unfold in me. I'm able to do things I'm unable to do. And I have been given a spiritual awakening to recognize that. And it continues to go on. I am right size now, more than I was. I ain't going to take like total, you know, I don't want to go back. But I learn all the time. I see all the time what you do for me, where I could go with this. And I have learned from the group where I got sober. But this day, there was nothing. And so for me, desperation is a badly wrapped gift, but an important gift in my recovery. And I dialed the phone. And an alcoholic answered that phone. They picked up the call. Thank you. And I try to pick up the call when you call. You know, I try to do it. Because sometimes it's just that moment where somebody's there and they're going to ask for help. And it's like, but I'm watching my show. Or, you know, it's like, pick it up, man. Remember when somebody picked it up for you. And this person talked about stuff. Now, look, I've been to AA before. I knew your story. I knew your steps. But when they were talking, I guess the difference was my desperation. I suddenly realized this ain't happening for me. It's too late. I knew that. The know-it-all knew it, you know. It's too late. It's out of reach. I can't move fast enough. And they talked about a life they had, which I realized I was not going to have. And they talked about, you know, I was just over. And then they said to me, you know what? If you want to clean up your act, maybe we can help you. Well, damn. That, for me, is that flimsy read the book talks about. Looked like nothing. But in that moment, it was everything. You know what I'm saying? And I couldn't ask him, what does that mean? I could not ask that. Because what if he said something to me? This is Clancy, my first sponsor. What if he said something to me I couldn't do? I couldn't stand it. I just felt a little hope, and I didn't want it knocked out of the box. So what I did is I just got on a plane, and I came over to Los Angeles, you know, and like bat out of hell airlines. I don't even remember what airline. I just bat out of hell, you know. And I remember getting out of that airplane and calling him, and I said, I'm here. He goes, who is this? You know, and it's me, you know, like, you know, send the car. I don't know what. And he's like, damn, you could have let me know. That is the paradigm of my whole life. You should all know what's going on with me, you know. But that's the Pacific group. That's where I got sober. One alcoholic yelling at another. You know, I don't know if you've heard of them. I love them. They tormented me is how I felt. They saved my life. Because to a man after man, woman, people after people, they said, you got a sponsor, you got a commitment, you know, where's your next meeting? I hated them, but they were the making of me, you know, and I'm gonna just describe the first meeting that I went to, their big home group. We got a big home group meeting on Wednesday. The first time I went to that meeting, here's how that went down for me. In case you think you ain't able to get this, because if I'm able to get it, you can get it in your sleep, in my opinion. I got a ride to the meeting. He was real nice. He had people put me up. And I'm such a loser. It's a miracle when I tell you this. Because, like, he had this lady put me up, and I started dating. That's what I called it. I think the old-timers would have called it something else. And she threw me out. You know, she wasn't going to put up with that. And so that's how it kind of, and then people were giving me rides, they didn't have a car, and I show up at this meeting, and you know, like, we can get 600 to 900, sometimes 1,200 people at this meeting. That is way too many people for me. And they didn't look like alcoholics either. And you do not particularly look like alcoholics to me, as a matter of fact. And so I got that attack of self-centered fear, just like in kindergarten. I had come all the way from England on that plane, left everything I owned, which was like about this much, but, you know, everything to me. And now I'm like backpedaling. And the guy that gave me a ride noticed I was having like a psychotic episode. And so he says to me, well, you know, you're here. You might as well stay till the end of the meeting. And I thought, easy for you to say, you know, you got the car keys. And I just suddenly couldn't stand it. You know, I had all this like, oh yeah, like you were doing a disservice to me. And so I went in the meeting and I was doing this thing. Now I didn't do it so you could see it, but you know what I mean? I was doing it mentally, just waiting for the meeting to get over. And at the end of the meeting, I made a beeline for the exit to get out of there. And this guy intercepted me, and he said, how would you like a coffee commitment? You know, all friendly and everything. And I felt like saying to him, how would you like me to kick your ass? You know, I was just scared, spitless is what I was. I didn't know that. I get mad, and I think I'm, like, mad. I was so scared. And but what I said to him instead of that, because I'm a chicken, I said, oh, I couldn't take the coffee commitment. You know, I can't take the coffee commitment, so I'm going to be here 2 weeks. You know, I would love to have asked the person I was that night, where are you going now?
Yeah.
You know, where? And it was my great fortune, although it felt like my great misfortune, that I had nowhere else to go, that my family didn't want me around, that I'd been uninvited to one entire country. Thank you very much. And that I had been living illegally in England, and that I had a lot of problems. And the one that I did not want you to know, that I really dearly did not want you to know, is the fact I was married to two people at the same time. Now, you know, I don't know what your problems were like, but we're enough alike. You know, I don't know what you used to talk your way out of your problems, but I wasn't doing a very good job anymore. I could not do it. And so what I came up with this problem was I was going to treat it like an accounting problem. And, you know, I tried it on. If you're in that boat, don't use this. It doesn't work. Because, you know, I tried it on, and one of the people involved said, what do you mean you lost count? It ain't a high number, 1-2, you know. You know, you got nowhere to go. I got nowhere to go. I had nothing to say. It was just terrible. Anyway, so I had all that going on. And here's what he said to me, saved my life. He said, okay, take it for 2 weeks. And I couldn't think fast enough to come up with a whopper to get myself out of it, you know. And for some reason that felt to me, and I'm glad I didn't think otherwise, that it was like a binding contract or something. And I just felt so screwed, I'll tell you. But here's what happened for me in that meeting, kind of in that moment. The thing that had eluded me my entire, two other times in AA, my whole encounter with AA, this unicorn in my sobriety, this $100 word, surrender. I had not had it. And I feel I was surrendered. I was surrendered because this meeting had a lot of sobriety and I think it overwhelmed my alcoholism. That's what I think. And, you know, I said to you, I like to try to parlay some of these terms that I'm not that hep with spiritually. And it reminded me the way it felt like of drowning, because one time I was drowning. I'm an excellent swimmer. I underestimated a situation, and I was drowning. And, you know, the body does not ask to live. It fights to live. It's instinctive. It fights, and it fights, it fights, it fights, it fights, and then there's nothing left. And so I was drifting wherever I was going to end up. And out of nowhere, there was something to stand on. I don't know where it came from. I could get my head out of the water. I got air. I lived. You know, that's Alcoholics Anonymous. Big surprise. It's a big surprise for me. If you're newer here, I hope you find that surprise. And I really want to thank you guys for the 12-step call.